everyone again, and welcome back to another episode of the None of the Above show, a show for everything non-mainstream. This week we have a very special guest, and I'll introduce her in just a second. But I want to say that it has been really hard to get new content put together. So for everyone who has been tuning in, I want to thank you for persisting in listening to the show, and I will definitely have more stuff coming up in the next couple months. So this week I have Riley Raunch. You want to say hi?
Hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well.
So Riley, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit for people who have not heard you?
Yeah, sure. Riley Raunch, of course, and I'm a amateur trans porn model trying to be, just an all-around kink enthusiast, artist, musician, etc., gamer, nerd, whatever. But yeah, that's pretty much me. It's hard to sum up in a few words.
No, that's fair. Usually when I'm trying to introduce myself, I'm like, yeah, so I'm Laika, I'm Laika, but, things that I am, and then it's like, I'll give this whole list of different adjectives or, nouns and stuff that describe me or things I do or ways that I am, and it's kind of hard to, like, summarize that into a whole person, but...
Yeah. I can say you're not listing it, but...
Yeah. So you said you're a bit of a nerd, and something that you've mentioned before is your multiple computers, and that caught my interest because I used to have like a LAN with just a bunch of like Unix and Linux boxes and a few Windows machines, and then also like a VMS box or two. So I'm a huge like retro computing aficionado, I guess you could say. But I'm totally into like computer tech stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm totally a tech nerd. I wouldn't say I'm much of a retro computing, but I'm one of those kind of computer hoarders. So I'll have an old computer that I just can't throw away, and so I'll put a simple operating system like, Linux or some derivative of it to keep that computer alive.
Right.
I have, right now I only have 3 machines. I've had over 5, 6, I think at one point I actually had 10. Mm-hmm. But right now my 3 machines are, I've got a big tower gaming computer that's got decked out to the core with gaming hardware. It's running Windows 10 at the moment. I've got a laptop that's running Ubuntu Studio. I use it to do a lot of effects for my guitar. And then I've got a Surface Pro tablet that's running Bungie Ubuntu, which I do for my So
I've been my laptop that I use for a lot of stuff right now is dual booting Windows and I think it's Ubuntu, so it's the lightweight Ubuntu, which it doesn't come with like anything by default, and you have to install like a million packages to do anything. But cool. It's cool because all of the packages that I never use are not installed, and so it's nice and trimmed down. I used to use a lot of Slackware systems when I had a LAN of computers, and I really like how streamlined that can be. So, yeah. But, okay, so enough, like, computer nerd talk, because I can just go on. I know that you've had some interesting jobs and stuff. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I've done a wide variety of customer service to construction work. It's a lot. I guess it's just one of those things, trying to find out where the hell I'm going. But aside from the stuff that I've done, commission work and all that, aside from that, I've worked in restaurants, serving tables. I've worked, like I said, construction work, doing everything from basically framing walls and drywall and everything like that, painting. I mean, like construction painting, not artistic painting.
Yeah.
And then I worked in a hardware store for the longest time in their knife specialty department. And I sold knives like almost exclusively. And I had to learn everything about knife laws and high-end knives, how to sharpen them, how to basically how to do anything with a knife that was pertinent to selling it. So that was real interesting.
I bet that was. Yeah, that I know that you have some swords. Did you want to talk a little bit about those and like just kind of where they came from, what they mean to you, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I've got four samurai swords. Three of them are just, you know, show pieces that I found at just various flea markets and gun and knife shows. They're just, they more look pretty, and I'm a martial artist too, so they're more practice swords than anything else.
Gotcha.
The fourth sword that I have is actually from Japan. It was passed down to me from my grandfather, and he was in the Navy, I think.
Oh,
he was stationed in Japan. He had a sword commissioned from a sword maker out there, whatever. And then it was passed on to me later on. So that's like my special baby. I don't do anything with it. I don't really play with it. I just kind of look at it and say, hey, that's neat and pretty. But it actually has a crest with my grandfather's last name. The first initial of his last name, which is a K. It's got it imprinted on the blade. So it's pretty cool. It's really special.
That sounds like it. Yeah, wow. That's really impressive, and that's definitely something I would love to see one day. You said you're a martial artist, and so I'm curious about that, because I was definitely one of those kids that, like, I did a little bit of karate and then never stuck with it. And I kind of wonder, like, and I see people who do martial arts, and I'm like, I find it really impressive, especially the kind of the code of ethics that goes with a lot of it in terms of like honor and dedication and purpose. And so I don't know, tell me a little bit about your martial arts.
My training's a little small, a little in the way of training in a dojo. I've trained in Shotokan. I was a green belt when I quit that, or was forced to quit, I should say. It just, he moved away and I wasn't able to move with him.
Gotcha.
Then I took Tang Sudo, which is the Korean equivalent to Shotokan. It was, for me, it was an easy translation when moving styles. And I took that for a little while, and just kind of some inner dojo politics got me out of it. But again, I'd actually gotten a green belt, and that was just easy to get the green belt after having a green belt in Shotokan.
Right.
So, and then after that, I took just kind of a generic, self-defense course, and it was, I hate to say mixed martial arts because it's not literally MMA, but maybe a blended or combined martial arts into one self-defense thing. And it was cool. It was more about the practical uses of various martial arts. And but they didn't have a belting system, so I can't really say how far I got into it. But I took that for about 2 years and, you know, learned a lot of good information off that. And then after that, I did a lot of self-study, going through various martial arts and, you know, finding things that I thought would be helpful either from a discipline point of view, or from a practical use point of view, you know, that would benefit me in life to know. And that's pretty much my history. I do a lot of personal studies just simply because good dojos are not easy to find in my location. So, you know, if I ever find a good one, I want to go back. It's definitely something I miss.
Cool. Now, you mentioned discipline. And so that's something that, you know, it's one of those kind of ethics concepts that comes up in martial arts. And I'm wondering if that you found has translated over to other aspects of your life. Because some of the big proponents of teaching martial arts to children will say that it does have these core values that actually integrate into a lot of things outside of just physical activity. And I would think that would be true based on my own experience, but I'm curious about other people. So what has your experience been with that sort of thing?
Me personally, I would say, yeah, the sort of way you learn to handle yourself mentally in martial arts through discipline and just everything about it does easily translate into other forms of life. Like, just for instance, discipline that I learned in martial arts helped me push past like those jobs that I didn't like having. So it was kind of being able to keep my mind still and disciplined in working through a situation that I didn't like that allowed me to, you know, move past that one job and find something different that I could enjoy more, or whatever have you. But I think it's one of those things that you have to know how to take that mental aspect out of martial arts and be able to apply it to the rest of your life. And that,
right.
I mean, that requires you as a good student and a good teacher to tell you how to do that.
That's fair. Yeah, and I see that because where I've actually felt like I learned some sense of discipline was by going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor. And there's a lot of people that I meet in the rooms of AA who have gone through the steps and they don't drink, but the rest of their life is still shit. And so I think it's very easy for someone to take principles like that and not apply them to the rest of their life if they don't want to.
Right. And it's, and really and truly, I don't know, it's kind of an understanding of what you're learning. If you can't translate the basic ideas of any given system of learning, whether it's the math you learned in school or the discipline you learn in, say, the military or martial arts, or if it's the lessons learned in religion or the 12-step program or whatever have you, you can't translate that to the rest of your life, then there's really no point in learning them. I mean, because that's where they gain their value, is the translation beyond the medium that they're being given to.
And that's a good language that I like to use for that is the distinction between religion and spirituality. It's one thing to be part of a group that practices certain rituals. It's another thing to actually take away a sense of valuing what's around you and of seeing humans as equals and of wanting to seek your place where you can excel and you can be comfortable and you can live rightly in an environment that suits you. And like those sort of things, you know, those principles are found in so many religions, but there's so many practitioners of those religions who they, you know, it's like they do the basics for the religion and they don't really walk away with what I would call a spirituality. They believe in a concept of God, but they really have no sense of connection to like their place in the universe, which is, you know, kind of how I find my higher power, because I'm pagan.
Yeah, I totally agree. The problem, the fail in organized religion as a whole is that most of them have good life lessons tell you how to deal with your life. It's just the practitioners and the clergy who are not translating that message into what it needs to be, and instead they get too caught up in whatever they're getting caught up in, you know, the fundamental, what's actually written in the text. They get too caught up in that as opposed to the actual lessons that they need to learn. And that's where I think organized religion fails, is that, you know, it just, they get caught up in literally translating their text instead of, you know, metaphorically or figuratively translating it in the way that helps them.
Right. Definitely. So I'm going to jump back a little bit. You were talking about selling knives and learning a lot about knives, and so we had talked earlier very briefly about knife play. So I know this is a huge segue from spirituality to BDSM, although it's really not that big of a segue because BDSM can be a spiritual thing. So knife play, a lot of people like don't really have a solid concept of it. And I know it's actually fairly simple, but do you want to just give the audience like an overview real quick of how that actually works and how knife play scenes kind of play out, and maybe some of the different types of scene dynamics that can be explored by incorporating knives?
Yeah, the knife play is really simple, like you said. It really literally translates as you play with a knife in a BDSM scene, and it can be, you can make it as simple or complex after that as you want. It just kind of depends on how your kink is and how you tend to enjoy it. But basically, you use a knife either to provoke a mental reaction, which is really prominent in the circles that I've been in, is using the knife more for mental control rather than physical. Mm-hmm. And then, but on the physical side, you can still use it for, say, just scratching the skin, or, you know, in very rare, more extreme cases, actually cutting somebody. But again, that's more the extreme and rare version of knife play, is to physically cut. You see it more common that they're, you know, they're scratching or they're just holding the cold steel against your skin to provoke a reaction.
Right. I've had some really exciting knife play scenes that involved a lot of kind of talking and grappling, and then the knife was pulled and the blade was just pressed against my neck, and like the build up to the point where the knife was actually introduced was so exciting that like it was just this like, I don't know, it was like an intense fear but an intense elation at the same time, when suddenly there was a knife at my throat and like I was blindfolded and restrained, and oh my god, it was hot as fuck. And then there's like just a little bit of scratching after that, and just hearing you talk about the knife scenes, I was just like scratching myself and thinking about great scenes I've done, because it's just it's so much fun.
Oh yeah, no, I'm totally agree. Like I've a lot of my experience is just strictly the mental aspect of a knife. You know, whether you see it or don't. Like for instance, I mean, one of the ways I've used a knife personally is if I was the top or doming or whatever your word for the one in control is.
Right.
I would use, say, a folding knife or a switchblade or something like that. Something that makes a sound when you open the knife, like a click.
Uh-huh.
I would use that click as the trigger for an emotional reaction, and then push that reaction further by, say, just pressing the back end of the blade, the blunt, to their skin. And I mean, it would be almost as if they had physically seen the knife in my hand and I had touched them with the sharp end. I mean, it was really an uncanny how it works. But you know, a lot of my experiences is from that particular scenario, I guess you'd say.
There's another fun thing that you can do. Is you can, like, totally introduce anticipation of the knife or do, like, a little bit of very light, super light knife play. And then take a blade that's been in a freezer, so it's incredibly cold. And either the blade is not sharp at all, like it's been dulled down, or you take the blunt side of it and just press it really hard against someone. And the mental expectation of feeling that sharp cold and that intensity is that it's cutting, but it's not. And it's such a mind fuck.
Now, I've definitely done that. What I would do is I would set up like a bowl of ice and a bowl of hot water near the flame. And I would have, like you said, dulled knives or just in general, laying in the water so that the blade catches the temperature of the water or whatever have you. And then, yeah, use the temperature as a part of the reaction to stimulate the sensations of being cut or just the combination of steel at its temperature being pressed on the flesh. It really is a mindfuck, and I think it's one of my favorite aspects of BDSM as a whole is the mindfuck of doing anything. It's, to me, it's fun just receiving it.
For sure. It's arousal is so much a mental phenomenon, so you can do so much with that. And a lot of people who haven't really explored BDSM kind of look at it and they're like, a lot of that looks like it's a little uncomfortable or feels weird, and they don't realize that, you know, so many of those scenes can be set up in really interesting, exciting, and arousing ways. And then when you introduce sensations besides just regular vanilla sexual rubbing, it can be like, it's like suddenly realizing that you were only painting with one color your whole life.
I totally agree. And anybody that does anything pure of physical based arousal, whether it's sex, BDSM, porn, whatever you're doing, if it's just a physical thing, like based off your eyes and mind, or I shouldn't say mind, eyes and hearing or whatever, just based on the physical, you're missing out on sex as a whole. I mean, because the really good orgasms and experiences come from the extra mental part of it, whether it's you're in a loving relationship with somebody and the emotional connection drives you to have greater orgasm, or you're in a BDSM relationship where the control and fear is what's driving you to have a better sexual experience. And a lot of BDSM practitioners who have, you know, loads of experience come to realize that it's more the BDSM is more the mental aspect than it is the physical.
Oh yeah. If you can build a scene up by the way you structure it, it becomes so much more intense, because what you're actually doing is fostering a fantasy in the mind of the bottom. And reality, there's a guy I know who he teaches a lot of classes at a rope dojo that I've attended, Kyujin Baku Dojo. And one of the things he said is that it's really important to, like, work with scene dynamics. It's one thing to just put ropes on someone and do cool tricks with rope or do, like, nifty-looking suspensions. But it's so much more when you can actually make a scene out of that, where there's communication going on between the top and the bottom just through the motions of the rope being tied and how the bottom responds. And then using that communication, you can build up a fantasy in the mind of your rope bottom. And whatever you do in reality actually is never really going to match that fantasy, because the fantasy is all consuming and you can ignore reality. And if you can do that, you can do way intense, amazing rope scenes with just a couple pieces of rope and a few simple ties and not doing anything fancy. And that's totally true. Like, I've had some great rope scenes where it was, the scene dynamic was great and it wasn't anything fancy. It was just kind of ad-libbed with a couple simple ties. And, but it was intense because of the way the scene was developed.
I completely agree. I'm glad you mentioned rope bondage, because it's actually my favorite aspect of BDSM. I love it. I love looking at it, studying it, receiving it, giving it, both. I mean, I could make a career if it was possible off of rope bondage. It is beautiful. I love it.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's very much, you can take something simple like rope bondage and not have a whole lot of knowledge of knots and harnesses and ties and all the complex, but still use the way you perform it, the way you're tying it, the way you handle your submissive, or the way you interact with your dominant. You can use that as a way to just really fuel the everything about it, just the sexual drive, the fantasy, the the experience as a whole. I mean, it can definitely be used in so many ways mentally to give you a great experience that, you know, is unimaginable. I'm breathless thinking about it. I mean, I'm right now I'm imagining rope and I'm losing my train. Oh,
this gives me so many ideas of when we hang out down the road.
Oh yeah.
So many ideas. So that's gonna be fun.
Oh yeah.
So we're kind of talking about like the mental aspect of BDSM and sex, and I think that's a good tie-in, haha, to the next thing I wanted to go into. I know Yumi and some other models were chatting about things in the porn industry, and how there's been a lot of changes lately, but there's still things that could be changed. And, like, something that I think is really cool, like, a lot of the sites, like, the groovy sites have taken slurs out of the names, and, like, Shemale Strokers that Fran does is now Transational Fantasies. So a lot of sites are taking slurs out of the names because not every trans model's comfortable with them, which I think is really cool and affirming. And then, like, also, like, Stephen Groovy's been working with the Internet Adult Film Database to fix misgenderings of talent that's listed. So that's cool, and that's progress, but there's still a lot of aspects of the porn industry that could be better. And I was wondering if you had any particular thoughts on what you've considered would be, like, a good place for the industry, not necessarily even just trans porn, but just porn in general, to move forward.
I don't know. I've got a lot that I could actually say needs help. I think the biggest thing is moving away from the cheesy, stereotypical porn that's out there.
Right.
One big thing that we as models and any producers, writers, anybody else behind the camera can work towards just to better the field, to better the thing, but get beyond the cheesy scenes that are you know, hey, let's have sex. Oh, the pizza guy's here. I'm going to screw him. I mean,
right.
It is very formulaic. And after a while, it's old. And that's my biggest complaint about the porn industry, is that there is nothing else behind it other than old. And me personally, I want to be able to connect with the porn that I'm viewing it in some kind of way, you know?
Yeah.
Even if just kind of I see the emotion in a model's eyes when something happens, and that right there connects me to them. And, you know, something as simple as adding a little more emotion, a little more real orgasm rather than faking it, you know, in various things like that, or ensuring that the male top model has a legit hard on as opposed to struggling to keep it up.
Right.
Simple things like that to me would go a long way. But then you can get into stuff like adding a little bit of extra story or whatever that just kind of pops, that makes it, you know, more than just the cheesy pizza boy that gets fucked.
Yeah, because there's so many of the just kind of vanilla porn out there that I've watched a few minutes of, and then I'm like, okay, you know, I can basically skip to the cum shot, and then I've seen it, right? But there are so many, like, regular Hollywood movies out there that I'll watch, and, you know, I watch the way that characters interact, and you watch, like, the passion that develops between characters as they're getting into each other or struggling to decide if they're in love or something like that. And then, like, there'll be some sort of, either the movie will allude to them being sexually involved, or there might be a sex scene where you don't really get to see anything X-rated. And, like, that stuff is so hot, and it's like, that's the point where I would love to just see the fucking, right? And so I think that adding more authenticity and realism, and adding a more interesting backstory and more character development to porn, and there are like queer porn and kind of feminist porn projects out there that try to do some of this, can make it really interesting and exciting, because you actually engage with the characters. And it's more than just pure erotic arousal, you know. It actually engages more of your emotional cortex, and it produces a more memorable and stronger response.
Oh, yeah. No, I love the idea that, what is the official movement name? It's like porn for females, or something to the effect. But
porn for women or something like that.
Yeah. But basically it's taking the idea of porn and actually making it able to be more relatable to not just the female audience, but also the female performers.
Right.
Where they are legitimately becoming aroused during the scene, and they're not having to worry about, you know, drying up or any of the problems that happen behind the scenes of porn.
Right.
But they're not having to fake orgasms. And mm-hmm. to me, approaching it with that kind of mentality of improving the experience overall, not just for the audience, but for the models as well, I think that is just awesome. And I wish, like, all fields, all genres of porn would actually take a few notes from that handbook,
yeah,
and
definitely.
And start doing it more. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that all should do it, but more should do it.
Yeah, and something that I really like about the fetish porn that I've seen is usually the people doing some of the more extreme and more unusual fetish porn are people who, you know, like, they have a legitimate interest in it. And that can be really cool to watch, because you can tell that they're connecting with what's going on. Like, they're not just like, okay, now I stand here, move my hips this direction for 30 seconds, then we're gonna cut to this angle, and that can, you know, like, the difference between, I would say, fetish and mainstream porn, and then a lot of mainstream porn, especially that's produced by big studios, it can look really good visually, but, you know, those performers, you can tell they've done so much of the same thing, it's become mundane, uninteresting, and a lot of times you can read that lack of chemistry. And there's plenty of porn out there that it looks fucking beautiful, but it doesn't appeal to me just because of that. But then, like, I got some random free samples of some porn that it was done by a studio, but it had more of a storyline to it. And you could see that there was more development between the characters, and they interacted in a few different ways, and that was actually really hot to watch. Even though it was just straight vanilla porn, not kinky at all, very, like, boring setting, I actually enjoyed watching it because I connected with it more emotionally.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. What I've found as far as connection is more in the amateur stuff. I haven't seen professional done like that. I mean, it's not because it's not out there. It's just because I haven't found it.
Right.
But I've seen a lot of amateurs be able, like, if it's a couple or just somebody that I guess are good friends or whatever have you, they do have that extra connection. And
right.
Where they may lack in the ability to catch different angles or have perfect camera quality, their connection relates to me because it's legitimate, it's sincere, and they're not having to, you know, fake anything. I mean, it's two people actually aroused by each other, and it just happens to be on film.
Yeah. And you can much more easily feel like you're a part of the scene when you can read that chemistry in it. So yeah,
oh, yeah.
That's something that I definitely want to see more of. I know when I perform, I try to bring as much authenticity as possible to it. You know, and sometimes, like, the way something is being shot or just kind of the constraints of the shoot, not everything can be completely authentic. And, like, honestly, when I top, I usually need Viagra because being on estrogen for a couple of years has apparently done that to me. But, like, you know, I bring as much authenticity as I can because I believe in that sort of thing. Like, I think it makes better quality porn in terms of the emotional connection that the audience can make.
Oh, yeah. No, I completely agree. And I do the same thing. Most of the, I've got a ton of footage that I just scrapped, you know, just simply because I'd get midway through the scene and just completely lose interest, whether it be from, you know, complications of moving the camera around or, you know, drying up and it just becoming too uncomfortable to continue or whatever have you. I've had moments where I would start filming and be in the mood and then get out of the mood and just scrap the entire project, and for whatever reason, just because I was no longer into it. Because I feel like if I'm not going to be into it, my audience is not going to be into it. And, you know, there's no telling how many things that I've deleted and started over or whatever, postponed, just because I wasn't into it.
Yeah, definitely. So, I think one thing that's an important discussion to have is, like, consent in porn. And that doesn't come up quite as much in mainstream porn. But there are a few models out there who have reputations for violating consent. And some of that comes around, like, some of the extreme porn that's starting to go into the BDSM genre. And what ends up happening with that is kind of people see that and then they want to ban all violence in porn, which unfortunately can include lots of BDSM scenes that kind of appear violent, but there's actually very little physical harm or damage that gets done. And so, like, you sometimes see these discussions around that sort of thing, around extreme porn that, you know, has elements of violence to it. And I think it's important to be able to distinguish between things that are causing, like, actual damage and hurt. Or I guess maybe the word should be actual damage and harm versus just things that are painful or hurt physically. And I think that that's a discussion that I'm hoping there's going to start being a lot more of, especially after all the discussions about consent and power struggle in, you know, the post-Weinstein world that we now have. And it's really good that we're having those conversations, you know, outside of the adult industry. And I'm wondering if that's going to carry over to some of the debate about that. I was looking at, there's an interesting thread on an XBiz forum where people are talking about, like, that kind of extreme or violent porn. And so people are kind of discussing, like, how do you decide, like, whether something is good or bad for the models involved, and whether someone is being led into things that they're not completely aware of. And that kind of thing is a conversation that I hope people will be having more and more of. Especially, you know, like, because we're in this era now where, especially following some of the legal issues currently plaguing the maybe not so great leader of this country, with regards to the adult industry and his affiliations with people in it, there's kind of a focus on aspects of the adult industry that worries me sometimes, because, you know, I don't want to end up regressing in terms of the freedom the adult industry has. I don't know. Any thoughts on any of that?
You just hit me with a barrage of thoughts.
I know, right?
Okay. First and foremost, when it comes to anything involving kink, sex, whatever, consent is 100%. Consent is key. Period. If you don't have consent to do these things, whether you talked about them months prior to the scene or whether you're talking about it, you know, just moments before the scene, you have to have consent. It is not okay not to do anything to somebody without consent. And it doesn't matter if you're in a bedroom, a porn set, a BDSM club, wherever you are, I don't care. Consent is key, always. And to continue on that train of thought, if you're going into porn, it's your responsibility, both as a producer, as a model, no matter which part you're playing, but as producers and models, it is your responsibility to make sure that everyone involved is informed of what's going on in a scene.
Absolutely.
If the bottom or submissive in a scene doesn't know what's about to happen to them, then there are some people that need, in the least, an ass chewing.
Right.
At most, there's people that need to be arrested, because no model should ever enter into a scene without knowing fully what's about to happen to them. Whether they're top or bottom, it doesn't matter. You know, if a producer is pushing a top to do something that he is uncomfortable, or he or she is uncomfortable with doing to another person, then they need to tap out. They need to say no. Yeah. And they need to know, all of them need to know, that they can say no if maybe they're unsure if they're comfortable with something or not. I mean, and I can go on forever about consent, as far as you need to know what you're getting into and the fact that you can, in fact, say no to anything, even if you're not sure and you say, okay, well, I'll give it a try, and then you meet halfway down the road and you realize that this isn't the thing for you. Stop, say no. And another part of that, too, is if you're unsure or you're scared that something may happen to you that would push your level of consent, that you may not be able to get out of a situation, have somebody, a bodyguard, a friend, anybody, support, there with you to be able to help you get out of that situation. And you know, I know this wouldn't necessarily happen in a private bedroom, but say on a porn set, that's easy to arrange. And at least that would help them get out of a bad situation.
Yeah, if a studio is asking a performer to do any sort of really edgy scene and is saying that they cannot have a chaperone, like, near the set, then that's not a good sign. There are studios, like, and I've worked for a studio that did closed sets, but it's, like, little simple fetish things. It's not edgy at all. So, you know, that's not, like, an issue. But there's... What kind of came up in the Xbiz forum is, like, this studio that they tell performers, oh, we just want to shoot, like, this hardcore thing, and we need you to do, like, this and this before the shoot, and don't really explain why. And then, like, apparently when they get there, they, like, tell them, oh, we need you to do, like, this and this before the shoot while you're here. And then during the shoot, it actually turns into something that was kind of alluded to but not really explicitly told to the performer, and a lot of people are saying, like, hey, you know, what went down is not okay. Even performers that are willing to do that type of work are uncomfortable with the fact that they were kind of, you know, misled into that, doing that type of scene. And I think that what would be really useful is if more studios started adopting policies where consent was valued more than some other things. Because, like, what can kind of happen now, I think, is that a lot of people will maybe find themselves in a scene that they weren't entirely prepared to do, but they don't want to say no because then the producer's going to be like, oh, well, that's what we hired you to do, so if you can't do that, then we can't pay you. And so I think if we shifted towards a culture where producers and studios were willing and ready for performers to be able to give feedback on what they can do during a shoot, you know, anything that comes up during the shoot that's not, like, explicitly said ahead of time, because, you know, if you're signing up to top for a scene that is your primary job and you can't top that day, it's understandable why a studio might not want to pay you. But if there's things that kind of get introduced during filming and the producer's like, ooh, this would work really good, you know, between the two of you during the scene, that people shouldn't feel pressure to go along with things that weren't explicitly stated at the beginning, just because they're afraid that, you know, it's going to turn into a dramatic thing or that they won't end up getting paid. So I think that's something that I'm really hoping to see more of a shift toward. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. What one thing from a lot of the consent horror stories that I've read myself, I think one thing that would be helpful, just for models and producers to get into the habit to, is outline what exactly is supposed to happen in a scene, make sure the model's okay with it. But also have basically a side note of saying, okay, if we deviate from the plan, what kind of things are you okay with and what kind of things are you hardline no with? And both models and producers need to get into this habit. Models need to expressly say, no matter what happens, you can't do this to me. And producers need to be asking the question, if we deviate from the plan, what are you okay with doing and not? Because, and you see this in the BDSM community a lot too, and this is why DOMs and subs work out contracts and understand each other's limits and kinks and everything, what their soft limits are, what they're okay with handling, but maybe not for long, and what their hard limits are, as in never do this to me. And I think the porn industry could definitely benefit from something like that to weed out these cases of, you know, was this consensual, was it not?
Right.
And if you have at least that baseline of understanding, then when it goes beyond your consent, you can at least have something to back up legal involvement to prosecute anybody that goes beyond your level of consent, because lines start to blur when you keep it all vague and without a hard line understanding of what's okay.
Right, and absolutely. Yeah, and I don't want to cut you off or anything, but we're actually coming up on near time for the show, which that's a sign that it's a good show, because like we got so into our discussions and I'm like, oh my god, it's almost time for me to like end the show. But
I totally didn't even notice.
But one thing that I wanted to make sure that I got to, I know you do art, so just briefly, do you want to talk a little bit about the art that you do, where some people might be able to find it if they're curious, and then also just like how people can look you up if they want to see your porn, if they want to know more about you, just some of your social media stuff, just pimp you out a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. The type of art that I do, I actually do a lot of art. The only thing that I really show publicly is I do like sort of an anime style, kind of naughty type drawings.
Right.
Rule 34's original characters, stuff like that. I do a lot of that, and that's more of what's publicly out there. And I also do a lot of splash art, generically speaking, just kind of the stuff you'd use for like t-shirt logos and tattoos, stuff like that. That's what everybody sees, and a lot of what I do, like, to my own is I do some abstract work, I do crafting or whatever, you know, just basically putting pencil to paper and seeing what comes out. But even in that, what people don't see publicly, there's a lot of influence from me learning, like, the anime style and the splash art tattoo design style.
Right.
It translates into that. So I think more importantly, it's the first set of art that I actually show people that I can claim it's mine.
So I know you said that you had to set up a new DeviantArt profile that, you know, only has some of your stuff on it. But if someone wanted to see that, how would they find it?
Hold on, I'm trying to find the actual URL, because everything I do is based off of Riley Ronch. Now, in some stuff, it's Riley Ronch, one word. Sometimes I put a period in between Riley and Ronch. Sometimes I put a hyphen. So give me just a moment.
Oh, no worries. And just for everyone who's listening, I always try to link to the people that I interview and any like social media or art pages or music pages that I can find in the show's description. This show is now on iHeartRadio, as well as iTunes and Podbean that it's been on for a while. And the show description should have the links. So if you just randomly find this audio file floating on the internet, you can look the show up, noneoftheaboves.podbean.com has the archives of everything, real easy to download with all the links, and that's aboves, plural. But go ahead, Riley.
Okay, I did finally get the official URL. My DeviantArt is riley-ronch at .deviantart.com. Or you can always find my random post on Twitter when I randomly post artwork that I've been messing around with. And that's just at Riley Ronch 11.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the show today. This was super fun. And I know we wanted to talk music and we wanted to talk tranny chasers and social media. We will have to do like another episode with that. And then we can also go more into the different styles of art you do and the influences for those. Because I know we were talking a little bit about the importance of that earlier, because I admitted that I can appreciate art, but I really don't know jack shit about a lot of it. So I don't even know what questions to ask. But yeah, we'll totally have to go into that in another show.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it. I'm shocked that we've already burned through the time. So yeah, I mean, whatever. I've got a lot to talk about.
Oh yeah, definitely. And there is a super secret project that Riley and Laika may or may not be involved in, that may or may not be happening later this year, and I can't tell you anything about that. But look forward, stay tuned, keep checking back on our social media, because probably this fall there will be some cool news. So this was the None of the Above show. Thank you, everyone. I have a bunch of interviews coming up. I'm definitely going to have, like, the major porn site person that I keep saying that I'm going to have, and I won't say the name of, because I'm waiting for the time to be right in terms of PR releases for her site. So, but that's definitely still going to happen. And I have some other interviews lined up for the next couple months. Should be getting Amy Mercury back and doing another show with her. And another one or two guests that I've had before, I will doing repeat shows with. So, everyone, stay tuned. None of the above, stoppodbean.com. I can't remember the URL for iTunes or iHeartRadio off the top of my head, but this show is on sfdradio.com. That's S as in Szechuan, F as in Frankfurter, D as in donut, sfdradio.com.
Delta.
Yeah, or you could use the International Phonetic Alphabet, but where's the fun in that? So, yeah, and new episodes are still Mondays at 7 p.m. when I have them, and that's Eastern Daylight Time. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in. This was a super fun show, and I will be back with new content really soon, probably in just another week or two. Hope everyone has a wonderful evening. Take care.